From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. A lot going on in the upper chamber of Congress today. The hopes of a filibuster-proof Senate for the Democrats has been shattered, at least on paper. That after Republican Senator Saxby Chambliss defeated Democratic challenger Jim Martin in yesterday's Georgia runoff. The man appointed governor of New York is now going to have to appoint Hillary Clinton's Senate replacement. But who? And the president-elect names another cabinet secretary while the outgoing president goes public with a candid assessment of his 8 years in the White House. Here to help us break down and through the latest political news is Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, and Robert George, associate editorial page editor for the New York Post. Hello, everybody. How
Hello
are you?
Hello there, Tony. Hello.
Hey,
there,
Tony. Nice
Robert.
To hear from you.
Nice to have you back with me again. Let's talk about topic number one. Republican Senator Saxby Chambliss won a decisive victory Tuesday over Democrat Jim Martin, as we said, in the Georgia Senate runoff race. Robert, Chambliss ran on a platform of limiting the power of Democrats in Congress specifically. How much did the notion of the Democrats having full control of the Senate influence the voters, do you think?
I would guess it would probably had a lot to do with it. I mean, keep in mind, it was Georgia has this little unique runoff situation where you have to have 50 plus one to actually get to actually win, or it goes to the runoff. So it's not surprising that Chambliss won in that kind of a setting. But I think the idea that not only do you have a Democrat in the White House, but you've got at least 58 Democratic senators and large numbers in the House. The idea of putting at least some kind of a check on the power of the Democrats was probably appealing to a number of what is still a rather conservative electorate in Georgia.
You know, interesting, I think, Mary, is this. Even had Martin won and even had the Democrats been able to get what they considered a filibuster-proof number at 60, there's no guarantee of any of that with people crossing the aisles these days, is there?
Absolutely. And besides, two of those 58 are independents, Bernie Sanders and Joe Lieberman, but they vote caucus with the Democrats. But also, you've got Olympia Snowe and Susan Collins from Maine, who are more liberal Republicans, and the Democrats have Mary Landrieu from Louisiana and Ben Nelson.
And Ben Pryor from Arkansas, too.
Yes. They've got folks who are in the middle. What it really means is that the constraint on who to nominate for the courts is that you can't Obama, if he were to choose to do so, and I don't think he would do it anyway, won't choose anyone who's not sort of a centrist, a sort of moderate centrist, because there's always the danger that people will feel like they need to filibuster. And it also will have a constraint on some of the legislation, but for some of it, it won't make any difference because Collins and Snowe have already said that they're in favor of a lot of things that are on Obama's plate. But people just have to understand that there are Democrats who are moderate, who vote the way moderate and to the right Republicans vote, and there are Republicans who vote the way liberal Democrats
Absolutely.
Do.
Absolutely. Robert, let me follow up with one other question on this before we go to topic two, and that's this. Sarah Palin, we're not going to talk about her, but this is just the introduction
Let's talk
to it.
About
okay.
It.
Sarah Palin went down to Georgia to stump on behalf of Chambliss, and I believe that Bill Clinton did as well, but no Obama, and there's been some question as to whether or not he should have or should not have. Do you think that the president-elect threw the Democratic challenger under the bus?
No, I think I would not be the one giving him advice, but I think he was very smart. If you look at the electorate, Georgia is still a red state. Had he gone down there and helped, say, pump up some of his supporters, got more of the black vote out, he would have narrowed it. And so instead of being a 58-42 win, it would have might have been 55-45 or something like that. But the downside would have been he would have expended political capital in a race that the Democrat was definitely going to be behind anyway. So I think he was very smart just to let it play out.
Mary, you know, I asked him and not you that question, but I'm going want to move on to another topic. I've got something better for you. Okay. President-elect tapped New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson for the Commerce Cabinet post today, introducing him this morning. I was struck by a question during a news conference from a Latino reporter who asked why Richardson didn't get a better position, his words, in the administration, to which the president-elect answered, quote, commerce is a pretty good job. What do you make of the Richardson choice?
Well, the questioner is quite correct. I remember when Bill Clinton appointed Ron Brown, who had chaired the DNC and has helped him to get elected president, to be Secretary of Commerce. A number of us were asking why Ron didn't get a better post. Ron himself was asking why he didn't get a more prestigious post. There's a pecking order in the cabinet, and commerce is not, you know, one of the top departments. It is a very good post, and it has a lot of possibilities, and I'm sure that Bill Richardson will, in fact, take advantage of the possibilities and do a good job. He deserves something because he switched sides, even though he owed his whole career in public life to the Clintons, who appointed him to, Bill Clinton appointed him to U.N. ambassador and Secretary of Energy and the like. And
well, let me jump in to ask you this. What about that? Because the fact that he turned and was called a Judas and other bad things
by James Carville.
And Bill Clinton was not very happy with him as well. Is that a potential point of friction on the Obama team?
No, it's campaign stuff. I mean, campaign rhetoric. People say all kinds of things and call people all kinds of names and the like, and the public has to understand that it's campaign rhetoric, and when it's over, now people just move on.
All right.
Well, it may be, I would say, though, that if you're Richardson, though, you might be find it a little bit galling, though, that you're probably more qualified to be Secretary of State than, I mean, just in terms of your resume, than, say, Hillary Clinton, and then Hillary Clinton got Secretary of State instead, so that might be a little bit frustrating.
You could argue that Bill Richardson, by switching sides like that, even though he owed everything to the Clintons, that one might be a little skeptical about his consistency if you were Obama. I don't know if that's the case.
That's an interesting point, Mary. Yeah. All right, I got another topic talking about Hillary Clinton, as a matter of fact. Let's follow it up with this, because now that she has officially been nominated for Secretary of State, the big question is, who is going to replace her? Now, the list of potential candidates is long and growing. The names Cuomo, Kennedy Jr., even Bill Clinton. My question, Robert, for you is there pressure? How much pressure is there on New York Governor David Paterson to pick a particular person?
Well, of course there's a lot of, you know, New York obviously is a place, as you may have heard, is a place of lots of egos. And so in just the names that you rattled off there, you know, it sounds like if you have to have a good family name even just to get to first base on this whole selection process. There's a lot of, Bill Clinton has basically ruled himself out, by the way, as has Bobby Kennedy, as has Bobby Kennedy Jr. But there is a lot of jockeying back and forth. Andrew Cuomo is definitely a name that has been popped around a lot, and that might be a kind of a twofer, because it's a big enough name that it fits into a slot that has been previously occupied by Hillary Clinton and a Daniel Patrick Moynihan and a Robert Kennedy and so forth. At the same time, it also conveniently moves Cuomo out of the way of challenging David Paterson potentially in a Democratic gubernatorial primary in 2 years. Other names that have been put around are Nydia Velazquez, because some people believe it's time that there's an Hispanic gets a Senate position in New York. So there's definitely a lot of jockeying. Yesterday, Governor Paterson announced kind of an advisory council that's going to be helping him with it, including Charles Schumer, Charlie Rangel, Congressman Gregory Meeks, and a couple of other people. So, we've got more than a month before he has to make a selection, because Hillary Clinton said she's not going to be giving up the seat until she is formally approved by the Senate.
Well, you know, I would think, Mary, given the fact that Hillary Clinton was in that position, how powerful she was, how popular she was, and how she came within a whisker of being the Democratic nominee for president, that a female would have to be put in that position? Would you think that's
right? I've heard that what David Patterson really needs is a Latina Jewish woman who is a leader in the disability rights movement and happens to come from upstate New York.
Bingo.
I don't know anybody like that. So I don't think there's any great pressure to actually some people have talked about Nita Loy as another person. But Andy Cuomo looks to me like he's the front runner, because I saw a poll that showed that in New York State, most people hadn't heard of any of the other people they were talking about. So he started out with that advantage. And it does keep him from running for governor, which is next logical thing after you've been attorney general in New York.
Now, but of course, there's some of these interesting kind of stuff going on behind the scenes here, because the scuttlebutt amongst the various political types is that Charles Schumer, who has been the senior senator from New York mm-hmm. for several years, has been kind of chafing under the bit about having been in the shadow of Hillary Clinton, who is technically the junior senator, and he would rather have somebody who would clearly give deference to him as the senior senator. Andrew Cuomo does not fit that category. So
I'm not sure Charles Schumer has that kind of ego. He's widely known for not having an ego.
I hope our listeners got the sarcasm.
That was really obviously an interesting observation on your part, and one that would be interesting for him. I mean, consider the fact that David Patterson wasn't even elected to the position that he is in. He fell into it through the back door, and now he gets to make this appointment as well.
Tony, you should keep in mind, just to show you how potentially dysfunctional the New York government will look like, if Andrew Cuomo is selected as a senator, it would mean that all three statewide offices in New York would be filled with people who were not elected
right,
to those positions.
Who were appointed, absolutely. And let me ask you both to hold on. We have a lot more to talk about, including President Bush's appearances on ABC television talking about his 8 years. We're going to come back with that conversation in just a moment. This is News and Notes, and I'm Tony Cox. We're back talking about politics with Robert George, Associate Editorial Page Editor for the New York Post, and Mary Frances Berry, Professor of History at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. So let's get right back into it. I want to talk about the president, ladies and gentlemen. Back in 2004, President Bush was asked what the biggest mistake of his administration was, and he had difficulty coming up with an answer.
I wish you'd have given me this written question ahead of time so I could plan for it. John, I'm sure historians will look back and say, gosh, he could have done it better this way or that way. I'm sure something will pop into my head here in the midst of this press conference, all the pressure of trying to come up with an answer, but it hadn't yet.
All right, let's fast forward 4 years. President Bush now preparing to exit the White House, and in an interview with ABC's Charles Gibson, the president was much more reflective about the shortcomings of his administration.
I don't know. I mean, the biggest regret of all the presidency has to have been the intelligence failure in Iraq. A lot of people put their reputations on the line and said, the weapons of mass destruction is a reason to remove Saddam Hussein. It wasn't just people in my administration. And, that's not a do-over, I wish the intelligence had been different, I guess.
So, Robert, what's the difference?
Well, the difference is he had 4 years to get the answer this time. He said he wanted a little bit of a preparation. This time he had 4 years for it. To give the president a certain amount of due. I mean, when you're leaving office, you're in a sense leaving the political life and you're moving into the post-presidential statesman life. And so you can be a little bit more candid about, certain failings and so forth. And I think that's what you're seeing here. And basically there is there's a complete and total broad assessment, whether it's conservatives, liberals, whatever, that, the intelligence on Iraq was clearly wrong. And so, I mean, in a sense, that's a safe answer. I mean, he's not going to go so far as to say that, you know, it was a mistake to go into Iraq. And he's definitely sticking to his guns on that. So, in a sense, it's an accurate thing to say, but it's also a safe choice as well.
Well, Mary, he said that he was proud that he did not compromise his principles. So is this a changed man or the same man speaking with different words now?
Well, I think it's the same man because, remember, 2004, yes, it was 4 years ago, and also we were at a different place in the war in Iraq then than we are now in terms of the policy and what was happening on the ground and all the rest. And the debate in the country about whether there were weapons of mass destruction, whereas most people believed there were still a lot of conservatives who kept insisting that there were weapons. The timing was entirely different. There's no advantage to him now to keep on, as Robert said, saying that, you know, he believes there are, there were, when in fact everybody, I mean, there's consensus now broadly. And I did note that he is sticking by his principles. He said that going into the war, he didn't repudiate that. He thinks it was still a good idea to go into Iraq. I didn't hear him repudiate any of his policy positions on any of the issues. He was just more candid about his own thinking, saying that he wasn't prepared to be a war president when he came in. He was talking about events and not himself, you know, personally, and how events overtake presidents. So I think it's right that he stuck by his principles. Maybe he shouldn't have in some cases, but I think he did.
One of the things that his wife said during the interview was that she has had people come up to her thanking her on behalf of her husband for keeping America safe. Do you think the public generally feels that way, Robert?
I think that when you assess a presidency, you have to look at the complete picture, and the fact that there has not been any kind of a follow-up attack on U.S. soil since 9/11, I think accrues to the president's benefit, as it would accrue to any president, and so I mean I think that's certainly a fair statement. Now, obviously, there's a whole lot of other things that have gone on that have not gone so well on the economy as well as on foreign policy, but you do have to give credit where credit is due.
We will give the credit, though, I think. First of all, we have to give the blame for not reading the intelligence on what might happen 9/11 when the information was made available to them when they came in office. They didn't take it seriously. But the other thing is that if we get out of this next month and there is no attack on American soil, and certainly we all hope there won't be, yes, he should get credit, but we need to look to see from the record how many threats there were, you know, what actually happened. And Obama and his Secretary of State and his intelligence people will be able to look at all of the threats that have happened, and historians will be able to write about it, and then we will make a final judgment.
You know, I looked at him and I watched the interview, and I was thinking, this man must be pained to hear that his presidency is potentially one of the worst in the history of United States presidencies. Did you get a sense that that is something that hangs over his head, although he didn't directly speak to that, Robert?
Well, he has said, and he said this for a few years now, I mean, particularly when Iraq was in its worst shape approximately between 2005, late 2004 and into 2006 or so. He's basically said that he's looking to be judged not by the newspaper people who are writing the first draft of history, but the historians who are going to be looking at this, 10, 15, 20 years down the line. So, I mean, I think it may be personally painting for him, but I think he's hoping that he eventually will be vindicated by history. I think on the foreign policy front, the possibilities of that are slightly greater than they were a couple of years ago.
Okay.
However, on the economic side, I don't think it's going to look as good.
Well, the other thing is, quickly,
unfortunately,
is
got to stop you.
He betrayed his party, not just himself.
The Republicans will not be too happy with
me.
I love to
hear what Mary has to say, but unfortunately, the clock is telling me that we have to get out of here. So we'll have to hold on until we come back in a week
and
or so.
I think I was going to agree with Mary, too.
Oh, God, that would have been worth hearing. Mary Frances Berry is professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. She joined us from NPR headquarters in Washington. And Robert George, associate editorial page editor for the New York Post, he joined us from NPR studios in New York. A few weeks ago, we put a post on our blog, News and Views, asking you to tell us how you're managing in these tough economic times. One listener did just that, and he shared his story on our show. News and Notes web producer Jeffrey Bennett is back to tell us about it and to share your response. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tony.
So tell us about this News & Notes listener-turned-guest.
Right. Well, his name is James Smith. As you said, we put a request out for people to tell us their stories if they were laid off. And Smith, who is a military veteran who lives in Southern California, recently lost his manufacturing job. And here's part of what he said to our own Farai Today.
I don't know who to ask for help. I go to the different organizations, and they say that they give me advice on how to get a job and send me back out, and it's, you know, I've been out there.
And here's a part of what our listeners had to say, people who heard that interview. Ray Craig said, I wish him the best and hope we get to hear a positive update before long. Sandra Duncan said, imagine a veteran having to think about leaving the country just to find a job. And a reader named Drew listened and said, I just want Mr. Smith to know that my heart goes out to him, and I hope his situation improves. And I should say, this week we're looking for people who have actually found bright spots in the economy, folks who are actually making more money than they were before, and they can go to our blog and share their story with us.
Are these the stories that are dominating the blog, or are there others as well?
There are others. There's one story in particular about a Georgia lawmaker who wants the state's university system to consider merging historically black public colleges with nearby white institutions to save money. The move would effectively merge Albany State and Savannah State with their neighbors. And Bill M. wrote in our blog, I'm not saying HBCU should be immune to the current economic conditions, but it just seems odd that the greatest sacrifices are being asked of the schools least able to sacrifice. And Matthew Scallon said, if we are holding out the separate programs just out of a sense of racial pride, there's not much difference between that and Jim Crow.
I think we're going to be taking a closer look at that topic on tomorrow's show.
Right.
But I also understand, though, Jeff, that our YouTube channel is becoming very popular.
Yeah, it is. In particular, an in-studio performance by country singer Darius Rucker. And folks can watch that and all of our video interviews by going to YouTube and searching for the News and Notes channel.
Jeff, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Jeff Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes. He joined me from the studios of NPR West. Now we've got our bloggers roundtable and what they're talking about online. They left Reverend Wright's United Church of Christ in Chicago, but where will the Obama family worship now once they're in the White House? What do President Bush, Senator Orrin Hatch, and singer Carly Simon have in common? The presidential pardon of hip-hop's John Forte. It's a hot internet topic. Plus, are McDonald's urban commercials cool, corny, or perhaps offensive? We'll see what the buzz is all about at the Golden Arches. Let's turn to our bloggers now. Here to weigh in, Jim Collier, who writes the blog Acting White. Carmen Van Kerkhove, she blogs at Racialicious and heads the anti-racism training company New Demographic. And education analyst Casey Lartig. His blog is The Casey Lartig Show. Casey, did I say it right?
Hey, don't worry. I've had enough experience with people mispronouncing.
Well,
I just
hate to get
it.
People's names wrong.
Casey Lartig.
Lartig. Okay,
yes,
that was
sir.
Close. That was close. I'll take
close.
That. Hey, everybody, welcome.
All right, thanks.
Thanks for having
Hello.
Us.
Hello.
Let's start with this one, the Obamas and worship. With President-elect Obama's impending move to Washington in January, folks want to know where will the Obamas go to church? Now, Mr. Obama's last church choice nearly derailed his presidential aspirations after his former pastor, Jeremiah Wright, was shown preaching anti-American and racially charged sermons. Mr. Obama then distanced himself from Mr. Wright, but Reverend Wright didn't let it end there.
And I said to Barack Obama last year, if you get elected, November the 5th, I'm coming after you because you'll be representing a government whose policies grind under people.
So, Jim Collier, this time around, where the president goes to church is going to matter to some people, isn't it?
Well, I think it does. But, I think the reality here is that presidents and even candidates for president generally go to church as politicians first and as individual citizens second, because it does weigh in, you know, as they go forward. And I think in the case now that President-elect Obama is definitely a politician, and he will be supporting and presenting programs and making decisions that really don't fall in the category, even under the category of what should be churchly or reviewed as churchly. And so I think this is why presidents in general in office don't go to church.
Well, Carmen, let me read a blog posting to you and get your response to it. It's this. If Americans really believed in the separation of church and state, this would not be an issue. We black people need to abandon the idea that Obama is exclusively our spokesman. Obama, who is just as white as he is black, but people conveniently overlook that anyway. What do you say to that?
Do we have time to get into the one-drop rule? I don't know if I'm on this show. But yeah, this is definitely a thorny topic because, you know, as a lot of columnists have pointed out, people will be looking to see if he joins a church that's predominantly black, predominantly white. You know, both of those scenarios will be interpreted differently. But then there's also the other issue of what kind of philosophy the church stands for. You know, if he joins another church that has maybe a little bit more of a social justice agenda, could that turn into another liability the way his association with Reverend Wright did? But then again, if he joins a church that has no real progressive agenda and is maybe kind of bland, does that, again, send the wrong message? So I definitely don't envy the Obamas in having to make this decision.
It's interesting. We have not heard that people have sent in to the Obamas suggestions about where they might go to church, as they were so willing to do with suggestions about what kind of dog they should pick for the White House.
Casey Lartigue. Yeah, I'll give him suggestions.
I was going to ask you, because you're in Washington, D.C., where do you think they should
go?
Well,
you know, he's multiracial. He might want to think about being multi-church at the same time. He could just alternate on Sundays about which churches he goes to and kind of do it like Frederick Douglass style. I remember Frederick Douglass, when he was getting criticized for marrying a white woman, you know, his second wife, he said that the race of his first wife was the same as his mother and that the race of his second wife was the same as his father. So leave me alone. And I think the Obamas, unfortunately, I don't understand the interest in it. For me, if he goes to no church, if he sets up a separate cult, whatever it is, I mean, that's his choice.
Some would argue he has set up a separate cult.
Well, I know, you know, all the interest in the puppies, his kids' chores, where they go to school and everything else. And is this a good time for me to say I have some 1990 Obama newspaper articles I'd like to sell to all the crazy Obama people out there?
Well, you know, one of the things he might do, you mentioned going to different churches. That would be taking a book from the page of George W. Bush, who went to different churches and didn't express a particular denomination during his presidency, I believe. But there is precedent for presidents picking a particular church. But with this president campaigning in part on his belief in God and his faith in God, it's made it kind of an issue for him, I think. You agree? Oh, let me ask you specifically, Jim, you agree with that?
Well, I mean, I think that the rhetoric of candidates is best left in the past. And I'm much more interested in decisions he makes as president. I don't want to be in his personal life. I don't want to be in his religious life. I just care about who he puts up, what he does, and how it affects the Joe Citizen or Jim Citizen here.
All right. Well, we've got some other topics that we are going to hit, but I'm going to ask all three of my blogger guests to just hold on. We're going to take a quick break. We will continue with our bloggers roundtable in just a moment. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. We're back with our bloggers roundtable with Jim Collier, who writes the blog Acting White, Carmen Van Kerkhove, who blogs at Racialicious, and education analyst Casey Lartigue, who blogs at the Casey Lartigue Show. All right, let's jump
right. Thank you.
I'm practicing. All right, let's talk about McDonald's. Okay, this is a topic that's cooking on the blogosphere right now. McDonald's has been making an obvious and concerted effort to market its products by using urban culture. Here's one commercial that almost looks and sounds like the latest R&B music video.
I woke up and found you creeping. Oh, girl, I know your secret.
You're dipping on me.
got that McNuggets loving.
You went to McDonald's?
It just ain't fair. Why can't you share your love with me?
Nice song, but you're still not getting any of my crispy, juicy McNuggets.
Girl, you got a 10-piece, please don't be stingy.
So, Casey, what's the big deal?
I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, white people get to be goofy all the time. You know, first of all, I wish I could sing like that. I mean, he sounds good. But I'm not the least bit offended. But it seems that there's always a TV commercial that has some bloggers and activists offended for a couple of days until the next TV commercial comes along and offends them.
Jim, you offended?
No, I'm not offended. I mean, I think that my 18-year-old daughter would really defend the commercial. But I think what's really going on here is this kind of commercial and this kind of focus really jumps into the split between sort of your lower educated income blacks and middle and upper middle income blacks or the black middle class, in fact, and we still hold on to some of our embarrassments and some of our expectations, and people don't want to see it front and center prime time on these sorts of commercials, and that's really what it is. But they are funny, and they do have their place. There's nothing wrong with
it. Well, we reached out to McDonald's. I'm going to read their comment, and then Carmen, come to you for your response. McDonald's said this, quote, "We have a responsibility to all of our customers to effectively reach them. We certainly take pride in all of our advertising and try to make it relevant and appealing to our audiences. We do take a lighthearted approach to effectively reach our customers. We certainly have no intention of offending anyone." So what do you say, Carmen?
You know, I would have an easier time taking this commercial as humor or satire if I hadn't seen all of the other tens of years of awful McDonald's commercials targeting African Americans, which are just so ham-fisted and awful. I mean, it's always like some black DJ spinning a burger on turntables or something really awful like that. And I think this is, to take it to a more serious topic, this is a reflection of really the lack of diversity in the advertising industry. I mean, if you follow the trade news at all, this is an industry that's been under investigation for the diversity or lack thereof in its hiring practices pretty much continuously since the 1960s. And, for those people who are interested in learning more about this, I would definitely suggest that you check out a blog called Multi Cult Classics. And he's an insider in the ad industry who writes a lot about this issue of race in the industry. I mean, this is an industry that's something like 95%. White, even though most of it is headquartered in New York City, which is one of the most diverse cities in the country. So I do think that, all jokes aside, there is a more serious issue.
Well, I want to get back to all the jokes. This is Casey, and say that if you're someone who is offended by that commercial, then it probably wasn't targeted at you.
That's an interesting point. And we should also point out that I'm told that that commercial was actually put together by a black advertising agency.
By now, McDonald's has learned its lesson. They're going to have somebody black in the room sign off on it.
And if the goal is to get the kid whose pants are drooping down around his knees in to buy a Big Mac, I mean, it's dead on. I mean, and I think that they shouldn't be drawn to task by trying to make a commercial to get someone who's wearing a three-piece suit who's got a uptown job who's eating in a very different kind of place. That doesn't make any sense. So
I'm not sure that it's designed to get the person whose pants are sagging so much as the person whose wallet is sagging to go in there.
Yeah.
Kids who
well,
can't
you know afford
what?
I'll
to eat
say this: better. I'm well educated, black. I have 2 degrees from Harvard. I like the commercial.
You like the commercial?
I liked it.
All right, when it was
settled.
There you go. Next topic.
Do you eat at McDonald's?
Yes, I do.
Oh no!
We have run out of time. We have less than 2 minutes, and the next topic is really an important one, so I'm not going to have an opportunity to ask all of you about it. But it has to do with the presidential pardon of the rapper John Forte, and apparently, from what I've read on the blogs, people are happy for him if they like him, unhappy because he seems to have people in high places who helped him. What's your take on that, Casey?
Okay, President Bush could have freed a lot of prison beds by pardoning a lot of other nonviolent drug offenders. This is a presidential pardon. It's going to be people who have connections. He doesn't just pick a random inmate number and release that inmate. It's going to be people who lobby and probably people with connections who will get through to the president because it is a presidential pardon.
All right, our time, unfortunately, is out, as I said, and I apologize to the other guests who are not going to have an opportunity to talk about that. We have been talking with Carmen Van Kerkhove, who blogs at Racialicious. She was at our New York studios. Jim Collier, who writes the blog Acting White. He was at the studios of the University of California, Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. And Casey Lartigue. Did I get it right again?
That's it. You got it. Thank
alrighty,
you.
Whose blog is called The Casey Lartigue Show. He was at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. You can find links to their blogs and to ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. And the conversation doesn't stop here. Our online series, Speak Your Mind, gives you a chance to sound off on the issues you care about. To find out how, go to our blog, nprnewsandviews.org, and click on Speak Your Mind. This is the season for presidential pardons, as we just made reference to, and that may be good news for some convicts, but for some judges and juries, it may be a time of dread, a period when verdicts and sentences get washed away with the stroke of a sympathetic pen. So if you were a judge or juror, how would a presidential pardon make you feel? We pose that question now to our regular News and Notes contributor, Judge Lynn Toler, the star of TV's Divorce Court. Judge Toler, nice to have you.
How are you, Tony?
I'm fine. Thank you very much. Let's start by talking about that pardon of rapper John Forte. President Bush, as we said, commuted his 14-year sentence for possessing 31 pounds of liquid cocaine with the intent to distribute. He had already served 7 years. He's due to be released on the 22nd of December. What's your reaction when a president, or what, not yours personally necessarily, but what do judges think when presidential pardons come along in this fashion?
I'm not really sure what judges in general think, because I really never had a long conversation or any conversation with a group of judges about that. I get a little offended about the Fortes of this world. There is a process for presidential pardons petitions. It's not just who you know, but it is, in the end, who lobbies for you when you do that. Such a large amount of cocaine, I have a little trouble with that. The idea of presidential pardons, and governors can do it as well on the state level, doesn't offend me as much as you might think, simply because although we have a good system of justice, it is run by human beings and as such is fallible. And no matter what you do, sometimes it just doesn't work out right. Kimba Smith. You know what I mean? There mm-hmm. has to be somebody at the end of the line that could say, despite all of our checks and balances, the system did not work in this circumstance, and I need to just step in and make it right. So I'm not offended by the ability to do it. Sometimes, however, I'm offended by those who actually are recipients of that.
And they're recipients not because they're deserving necessarily, but because of who their connections may be or how they're able to work the system.
Absolutely. I mean, there is a process. It's not just who can get a call into the president. There is a process. But when you have famous people and money and all of that, as in throughout the entire justice system, that process is a little more gentle and kind-hearted to you.
Well, let's talk about something else that was intended to be gentle and kind-hearted. It's the safe haven law. Although some parents obviously have been taking it to a place that it was not intended to be taken by the legislators who passed it. In Nebraska, for example, the law passed this year would let parents drop unwanted children off at hospitals and police stations. State would step in, take care of them. Every state in the union has a version of a safe haven law. But in Nebraska, lawmakers did not include an age limit, and that seemed to have been the problem, correct?
Correct. They were trying to be all inclusive and saying, you know, should there be a cutoff line at which we'll allow, you know, we will not try to give safe haven to children who are abandoned. And it was well intended, but I don't think they had a good concept of parenthood in this day and age, where we don't have those layers and layers of family and generations together and uncles and who can take care of everybody, and how frustrating 17 can be. And they needed an age limit on it and found out quickly that they would have to include one.
To say that it was remarkable is an understatement, that 34 kids were dropped off between July and November, some of them as old as 17
right.
years old. They could not have imagined that parents would do this, I suppose, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I don't think they could have imagined that parents would have done that. And I think that was an honest failure not to understand that in this day and age, we are now seeing a generation of children that were had by a generation of children. It, you know, back in my day, they having a kid outside of wedlock or younger was an outrageous thing. And we circled the wagons and all of that. But now it's not that uncommon. So you have, I think, a generation of parents that are unprepared for the trials and tribulations. And trust me, I've had 6 teenagers, it felt like 6 teenagers come through my house, and it is an all-day, everyday struggle and battle. And when you were young, when you started and didn't have the patience and the consistency and stability, they're even worse when they become teenagers. And we have to take a look at that as a society and see how we're going to deal with that.
It raises the question, I think, Judge Toler, I'd like to get your response, of whether or not a law like this makes sense regardless of the age. Does it?
I don't think so, and I'll tell you why. At any given point in time, I would have liked to gotten rid of my kids. Of course, I wouldn't have done it. I got a husband, a house, and all that, and I got a backup. But that's too easy and out. And when you have a generation of parents who haven't had the stability and the training, if we do that, it will crush whatever foster system care system that's already under the gun. It will just fall in on itself. What we need to do is establish support systems for families of, you know, young parents and teach them how to better deal with their children from, you know, the word go all the way into 18, because that's where the failure is. You can't just drop them off.
Isn't there a system in place to do that already? And I'm not talking necessarily about foster parenting, but aren't there support systems already in place for parents?
They are, but I don't think they're as comprehensive. I think things have to go real wrong before those support systems fall into place, and I think we need to learn more on a, you know, I remember when I was in high school, there was a course called Life and Family Living. It's about just how to live and raising people and all that. We don't do that as a course in practice, only when things start to go bad. So I think earlier education and more comprehensive education as what it is parenting involves would be necessary.
Is there a racial element to this as we bring our conversation to a close? Meaning, are there more black parents taking advantage of this, white parents, Latinos? Do we know even?
I don't know. The law was in Nebraska. I don't know. I don't think that's a place where there's a great diversity of people. But I really, really don't know.
You know, one of the other things, apparently, the issues that children are having with mental health, and that some families, parents, are not able to deal with their children who are suffering in that regard. Could you briefly speak to what should be done for them?
I mean, they do have support systems for the National Alliance of the Mentally Ill. I used to belong to it. I was on the board because I was in a family with a mentally ill parent. So those systems are in place. Of course, nobody has enough money and nobody has enough time. But I think these days we are becoming more and more cognizant of the mentally ill and trying to have a health system that now cares for them as they do for other illnesses, because it's the same thing.
All right. Well, we have the safe haven law, but it certainly has its challenges. We'll keep our eyes on it to see how it evolves. Judge Toler, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Judge Lynn Toler is the star of Divorce Court and author of My Mother's Rules, A Practical Guide to Becoming an Emotional Genius. She joined us from the studios of KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child.
She was one of the most treasured voices of the Civil Rights Movement, a voice that rang out over the March on Washington and inspired a generation of activists. The folk singer Odetta died Tuesday from heart disease. She was 77. Her Birmingham, Alabama childhood shaped her life and her rich sound. She performed for Presidents John F. Kennedy and Bill Clinton and had hoped to sing at President-elect Obama's inauguration. In 2005, I had the great pleasure to talk with Odetta. She told me about her early days in the segregated South.
I was a little black girl growing up in the United States, a country that had Jim Crow in the South with signs and Jim Crow in the North without signs. And we knew where we were to go and where we should not attempt to go. I studied classical voice, but when I got into the folk music area, the area started addressing the fury and frustration.
She channeled that fury into what she called liberation songs. Rosa Parks was once asked what music meant the most to her. All the songs Odetta sings, she said. Odetta continued to perform right up to her death. The passion of her voice will continue to shine as the embodiment of the civil rights struggle.
I have stockings of silk, shoes of fine green leather, combs to buckle my hair,